This is Thursday, the 5th of August at the Freiburg New Church Assembly. I'm George Dole, and my title for this morning is North and South. And as I look out and see the seating pattern here, it feels like I'm in church. All the empty rows up front, except my dear wife, who has the courage to set a fine example for others. Some of what I have to say this morning, I've already said to some extent in my first lecture, so you'll find yourselves free either to grumble at the repetition or feel smug at your recognition of it. I hope the experience will be a little more like meeting a familiar face in some rather different circumstances. The geography of biblical lands deserves closer attention than it usually gets. When we read a story that's set in familiar territory, all the references to directions and places make sense to us. They help us to make sense of the story. If the story were set in this area, we'd understand the references to Route 302 and the river and Jockey Cap, Lovell's Pond, and the White Mountains. So when a story is set in unfamiliar territory, we depend on the author to give us enough description that we have some idea of what is going on. Well, the Bible was written by and for people who lived where it happened. If it talked about going from Jerusalem to Jericho, they didn't need further explanation any more than we would need a description of how to get from here to North Conway. We'd be bored by it. We'd feel insulted almost. So the result is that there are factors at work in the literal story of which we are usually more or less unaware. And one of the most significant of these is the difference between the northern and southern halves of the Promised Land, the territories of Israel in the north and Judah in the south. By way of preface, let me offer a brief overview of the political relationships between Israel and Judah. We're accustomed to think of them as one nation that split in two after the death of Solomon. But a closer reading of the story raises some serious questions about this assumption. Going back to the book of Judges, there we have a picture of a people with no centralized government whatever. There was no king in Israel is a theme that's repeated 1, 2, 3, 4 times in the book of Judges. And when Gideon's son Abimelech tried to make himself king, it was a total disaster. The so-called judges were local leaders raised up to cope with specific local threats. And once the threat had vanished, they went back into obscurity. When the Philistines came on the scene, though, they presented a threat that did not go away. They were not simply raiders, they had territorial conquest in mind. The problem was no longer local and acute, sporadic. It had become chronic. And at the same time, Samuel had emerged as the first figure of national prominence since Joshua. It seems almost inevitable that people turned to him to find someone to draw everyone together and provide the necessary leadership. Well, the late great Sumerologist Thorkild Jacobson describes a striking parallel. In his analysis of political developments in 3rd millennium Mesopotamia, he says, and I quote, "The evidence suggests that kingship originally was a temporary office. A king was chosen as leader when war threatened and ceased to exercise authority once the emergency was over. Now the emergency had become chronic, and the office of the king had become permanent because of it. So had his army and the manning and maintenance of the city wall. Gradually, leadership in all major communal undertakings devolved on the king and became united in his person." Close quote. The leader chosen for the Israelites to meet this chronic threat was, of course, Saul. And we hear of him only as a leader in battle. That is, we find no references to the establishment of a capital city or a central government. It is hard to speak of Saul as king of a nation. He is essentially the leader of a united army. But this is what changed after the death of Saul. First of all, we're told that at the Lord's command, David went to Hebron. That's down here in the center of the southern territory. And that the people of Judah anointed him as king there. And next we learn that one of Saul's military commanders, Abner, arranged for one of Saul's sons to be made king over the northern territory. And that happened at Shechem up here. The text gives his name as Ish-bosheth, literally man of shame, which is almost certainly a euphemism for Ish-baal, man of Baal. But it is worth noting parenthetically, Baal is a word that means lord or master. It is not necessarily, it's more the title of a deity than a divine name. So after the death of Saul, we find two separate kingdoms, the south under David, the north under Ish-bosheth. Well, after 2 years on the throne, Ish-bosheth was assassinated, and the story goes on to say that the northern tribes then sent representatives to Hebron to ask David to be their king, and that King David made a covenant with them at Hebron before the Lord, and they anointed David king over Israel. And it seems to have been immediately after this that David took the city of Jerusalem with his own men and moved his capital there. But the numbers suggest that this did take some time. Specifically, we're told that Ish-bosheth ruled for 2 years and that David ruled in Hebron for 7.5 years. So there's a 5.5 year span there. Well, in moving his capital to Jerusalem, David was keeping it in the southern realm, but moving it as close as practical to the northern border, from Hebron to Jerusalem. It would be a little like moving the capital of the colonies from Atlanta, Georgia to Washington, D.C., sending a clear message to the northerners that they would have access to the seat of power. They wouldn't have to go to the very center of what had been the other kingdom. And this arrangement seems to have held up through the rest of David's reign, through the whole reign of Solomon, but thereafter things came apart. But they came apart again, not for the first time. They did so in a most intriguing way. Usually, when we read the Bible, we get to the end of a chapter, and we take a breath, or maybe even stop reading, and then later we start the next chapter. But listen to the last verse of 1 Kings 11 and the first verse of 1 Kings 12. Solomon slept with his fathers and was buried in the city of his father David, and Rehoboam his son reigned in his stead. Rehoboam went to Shechem because all Israel had come to Shechem to make him king. Well, if we follow that usual practice of pausing at the end of the chapter, we're likely not to notice what this is telling us. The fact that David reigned in Jerusalem made him king only over the southern tribes. The northern tribes assumed that they had the right to decide for themselves, and the fact that Rehoboam went to Shechem, he went voluntarily, is very clear evidence that he respected that right. And as the story turned out, they decided not to accept him as king. He wound up swallowing his pride and going home. This was not a rebellion. They felt they had the right to choose whom they wished as king. They decided not to choose Rehoboam, and he wound up realizing that there was not a thing he could do about it. So clearly, the unity of the united kingdom that we associate with the reigns of Saul, David, and Solomon was a fragile one. It had the powerful force of shared religious values and the charismatic abilities of David and Solomon, a recent history of military triumph and economic prosperity to hold it together. So what was it that kept pulling it apart? And this is where an understanding of the geography of the Promised Land comes to our rescue. Let me start with a summary. The Northern Kingdom is Greater Boston, and the Southern Kingdom is upstate New Hampshire. Transfer this contrast to an era before radio and television, and you have two quite distinct mindsets, one cosmopolitan and the other provincial, and each finds the other quite bewildering. To the Israelites, the Judeans look hopelessly backward and out of touch with the real world. Rather, it struck me later, the way Bible Belt Christians look to sophisticated residents of New York City. To the Judeans, the Israelites look as though they have lost touch with essential religious values, rather the way New York City looks to Bible Belt Christians. And there are solid topographical reasons for this. We need to remember, first of all, that in biblical times, people did travel on foot for the most part, so they were far more bound by their geographic circumstances than we are. And the southern territory, roughly from Jerusalem south, is mountainous. Its whole eastern border is the precipitous drop down to the Dead Sea and the Jordan River. The area around Jericho provides the only reasonable access, and that's a steep, steep climb. This border is one of the major, is a section of the Rift Valley, a huge geographical feature that extends south well into Africa. The southern border of Judah is the desert of the Negev. And to the west, toward the Mediterranean Sea, there is a steep descent or ascent, depending on which you're going, the direction you're going, between this heartland and the lowland territory of the later occupied by the Philistines. There are a couple of roads that follow riverbeds. I'm reminded of the way the north-south routes in New Hampshire are funneled through the notches. Not easy access. And it's only on the north, then, that there is really easy access to this mountain country. This means that Jerusalem is a kind of dead end, a kind of cul-de-sac. It's something you might go into if you had a reason to go into it, but it's not a place you ever go through. Now, the two great centers of empire in biblical times were Mesopotamia and Egypt. So let's follow the main route from the former to the latter. A straight line from Babylon to the Nile Delta would lead across some 400 miles of Arabian desert before it got even as far as the Dead Sea. And to follow that route would have been suicidal. The only way to sustain the romantic image of three wise men following a star straight from Babylon, Jerusalem, is to do two things. One, ignore the facts of geography, and two, quite misread the text of Matthew's gospel. No, the only practical way to make the trip was to join a caravan. There's safety in numbers, and you can carry enough supplies. And from Babylon, we'd go north and then west following the Euphrates River in order to be in constant reach of civilization, water, and supplies. The route comes to the upper reaches of the Euphrates. It comes to what is a relatively narrow strip of navigable land between the mountains to the north and the desert to the south. The desert stretches well up into this area. There's a constriction that funnels everything into Damascus and through. And then the mountains press the road more southerly. These are the hills, the Cedars of Lebanon. And both routes, the route crosses the Rift Valley, either just north or south of the Sea of Galilee, comes down plain through the plain, and at the exit once past Megiddo, it gradually converges with the seacoast all the way to Egypt and totally bypasses the land of Judah, the heartland of Judah. This makes Megiddo the focal point in our meeting of three continents, Europe through Asia Minor, Asia through Mesopotamia, and Africa through Egypt. And the streets of Megiddo would have been full of people wearing strange clothes, speaking strange languages. If we translate it into modern terms, we would imagine that there would have been an abundance of currency exchanges and ethnic restaurants and shops selling imported crafts. Foreign travel would have been a live option for the adventurous and perhaps even a necessity for the ambitious. And when people come back from other lands, they see their own land with fresh eyes. They question the way things have always been done. There are other ways that actually work. And all of this is quite alien to the provincial mindset of a realm like Judah. There is a sense of security and reliance on the tried and true. If it ain't broke, don't fix it. A few strange people may show up from time to time, especially in the capital city, but not enough to make a real difference, just enough to remind you that, gee, there are some strange people out there, aren't there? And the contrast between the volatile cosmopolitanism of the north and the conservative provincialism of the South shows up in the biblical narrative in a number of ways. Well, to begin with, it needs to be recognized that the story we have is told from a southern perspective. It was the southern kingdom that survived, and history is written by the winners. The temple in Jerusalem is the only true temple, for example. The fact that the original temple had been in Shiloh in the north is almost completely suppressed. The golden calves that Jeroboam set up in the two northern temples are taken to be idols, but there's no suggestion of disapproval of the 12 bulls supporting the great basin in Solomon's temple. Well, in general, we could probably say that the northern kingdom was comfortable with what we would now call religious pluralism, and that the southern kingdom regarded this as apostasy. And after I wrote this, it occurred to me, we have this tendency to read this story accepting the idea that God is the kind of God herein portrayed in the text, and rather forget that one of the central principles of our religion is that the good of all religions are saved. This policy hasn't changed. It's not a recent innovation on God's part. The good idolater is saved. The good worshiper of Baal is saved. The good person who bows down to the Asherah pole is saved. This is something that is totally unacceptable to the provincial, you might say, evangelical Judean mindset. Northerners, Israelites, would have met and dealt with people who did worship other gods, and they would have found some of them to be honorable, gentle, lovable individuals. Some of them more honorable, gentle, and lovable than some Orthodox believers. And if the biblical story had been told from their point of view, it would have sounded very different indeed. Well, the difference between North and South surfaces in the story in two particular ways. One is the extraordinary durability of the dynasty of David as contrasted to the volatility of kingship in the North. The Davidic dynasty lasted for over four centuries. And if we look at the history of the great empires, Egypt and Mesopotamia, we don't find anything that rivals that length. In Israel, violent revolution seems to have been as much the norm as the exception. There was not that sense of sanctity of the past, the sanctity of the way things had always been. Every king had to pay his dues, had to earn his keep, so to speak. And the fact that he was the son of the previous king gave him the opportunity to do this, but it was no guarantee of survival. And the other way in which the difference surfaces is the fact that Judah outlived Israel as an independent nation for more than 130 years. When Assyria found itself finally able to expand, control of that main route to Egypt was absolutely essential. Judah was off the beaten track. It could be safely ignored until the important part was secure. And it was only when Babylon took over the Assyrian Empire that Judah became the target of what was essentially a kind of mop-up operation. This is, of course, one of the reasons the story is told from a Judean perspective. They were the ones who lasted longest. And from that perspective, the fall of Israel and the survival of Judah was clear proof of the supremacy of the Jerusalem temple. Israel had fallen to Assyria because of her apostasy. And Judah did not fall because of her loyalty to the temple. And when Judah finally did fall, it was because of a series of kings who fell away from that loyalty. And through the account of the centuries of the divided kingdom, every king is judged by this standard. But as I read this morning, sometimes the evil kings do very well indeed, and the bad kings get clobbered. And Jeroboam, when it talked about his restoring the borders from the going in of Hamath, this is virtually restoring the full extent of the Davidic Empire, an extraordinary achievement. And for me, all this adds depth to the basic correspondence of Judah with our love side, the heart, and Israel with our truth side, the mind. In the larger sweep of the biblical narrative, I would see the establishment of the monarchy as an image of our own arrival at the relative independence of maturity. This makes the reigns of David and Solomon quite fitting images of our early adult years, when our energies and our hopes are high, and the extended period of the divided kingdom an equally fitting image of the years in which the world turns out not to be our oyster after all. So we're offered a picture of beginning our adult life with high idealism. We can see clearly the problems of the world, and we are setting out to solve them. It's an idealism based on theories and principles that make sense to us, but experience, the traditional school of hard knocks, has a way of pulling the rug out from under our theories, and we find ourselves constrained to do the best we can given the constant impact of circumstances beyond our control. And whether we admit it or not, we find ourselves sounding and behaving more and more like the people we used to criticize. We started out to be part of the solution, we wind up being part of the problem. The obvious primary arena of change in us is in our thinking. That is, we keep getting input from the world around us, facts we can't change but must in some way process and adjust to. We find ourselves making allowances, which is a less pejorative way of saying that we find ourselves compromising our ideals. I'm reminded of the prayer for the courage to change the things I can change, the patience to accept the things I can't change, and the wisdom to know the difference. And this realm of the wisdom to know the difference, this is Israel. This is where the action is. And as we become more honest with ourselves, we begin to recognize that we haven't always made the right choices. We've tended to accept things we might have changed. We seem less prone to err in the other direction and try to change what we can only accept unless we happen to be really have the crusader mentality. So let me quote briefly from my last lecture. With Egypt corresponding to memory knowledges or to information about this world, Assyria to reason, and Babylon to the love of dominion, we have an image of the way the outside world comes at us, so to speak. It offers us immense stores of information. It offers us fascinating intellectual challenges. It offers us paths to power, close quote. And suppose we use a little imagination to translate this into what it might be like to set out with the ideal of founding an environmentally sound business, say a constructive business, say a fitness center. Well, Egypt enters the picture with our need for a lot of information, information about legal requirements, equipment costs, terms and sources of financing, advertising, avenues for advertising, demographics and the like. Assyria enters the picture with our efforts to develop a coherent plan to decide what specific steps need to be taken in what sequence. And Babylon enters the picture with our need to be in control of the whole process so that it can remain focused on its original goal. But through much of the process, Babylon just stays in the background. We do keep a central focus on the basic goal of a fitness center, even while all the specifics are being adjusted to suit circumstances. And this, I would suggest, is represented in the biblical story by the relative constancy of Judah. It's a very important constancy. As I mentioned in response to Lee's lecture, I grew up with a picture of truth leading, the picture of the human condition in which the heart is inclined to selfishness and needs the guidance of the mind, enlightened by the word, in order to turn away from hell toward heaven. It's a useful picture. It's very necessary, especially in times of temptation. But there's also a sense, a very important sense, in which we would not listen to that corrective mind unless there were within us some inclination to do so. It's a point made quite forcefully in section 3207 of Secrets of Heaven. That is, somewhere within each of us there is that desire and intent to be a decent person. It's a desire that dies hard. The picture of the divided kingdom in which the mind is more prone to worldly compromise than the heart is well worth attending to. So Israel does fall to Assyria because our minds do succumb to what we feel as the need to make rational decisions in the real world and have good reasons for our compromises. But Judah falls to Babylon. And it does this when we realize the extent to which our desire and the extent to which our desire and intent to be decent individuals have been an expression of a desire to think well of ourselves. We want a favorable self-image, and self-image is high on the list of candidates as a translation for the word proprium. In the mountain fastnesses of our hearts, we survive for years as the ideal individuals we've always wanted to be. But while in the turmoil and the traffic of what we might regard as our public minds, we think in worldly terms, we choose by worldly standards. Let me close, though, by reminding us that the fall of Judah is not the end of the biblical story. The end of the second book of Kings is followed in the Swedenborgian canon by the first chapter of Isaiah. And the prophets in general move from the overpowering awareness of failure to the promise of redemption. A redemption that comes with the birth of the Lord and finds its fulfillment in the descent of the Holy City. That's where the manuscript stops. The floor is yours. Lee. Mm-hmm.
Here, whereas forces inside us that are also acting are maybe above where we're currently aware. So we think that the truth is leading because at the level where we are, it is. Mm-hmm. But then go dig a little deeper and we find that it was our heart all along that was guiding our truth, our mind, to lead us, to lead our heart to goodness. It's a very fascinating interplay of levels and of love and wisdom.
Yeah. Yeah, that is, that one I cited, 3207, is one of the places where that's said very, very clearly, and it's a riot in a way, because he's commenting on the statement that Rebecca took a veil and covered herself. And he uses this as an occasion to say that neither in this world or the next do we ever get beyond appearances of truth. We're always dealing with appearances. Pure truths are for the Lord alone. And he says, for example, and this gives us, it seems as though it must be truth that leads love and so on and so forth. But the real truth is that he's just told us we never get the real truth. So he said, here's the appearance and here's the real thing. But then he's already told us, but this isn't the real thing either.
Well, another appearance that he absolutely denies is that the material affects the spiritual.
Mm-hmm.
He says very clearly that inflow or influx is always from the divine to the spiritual to the material and never the reverse.
Yeah.
And yet it certainly looks to us like the world around us is affecting our spirit.
Mm-hmm.
He says, no, not really. Mm-hmm. It's always flowing the other direction. So put that in your pipe and smoke it.
Yeah.
I was just thinking of another analogy for truth. It's like the children of Israel going to the promised land. The truth is a bit like the journey from one place to another, and we never really see what that truth is until we finally get there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the truth in that, in the journey sense, the truth is always contextual in a sense. To get from here to North Conway, you go out the driveway and turn right. Well, turning right is not always the solution to all your problems. In other contexts, it's much better to turn left. Yeah, Laura was...
I was struck by, that Judah and Israel coexist, and so we must have a very strong period of time where we have both of those, and somehow we're trying to juggle that kind of country mouse security with city mouse learning new things, trying to strike out in different directions, and sort of where does that fit into the whole picture of what we're doing here?
One of the ways this has struck me is that each of us does have some principles and issues on which we really are unwilling to compromise. And for some this is deeper, for some this is shallower, let's say. There are some people who, this is a little bit for a long time, it was not a new church service if it wasn't the first order of service, period. And they're really wedded to an external form of worship. And others know they can afford to be flexible because they have something deeper going on. It may well be that for some the principles are the principles are kind of shaky. Some people their main principle seems to be I don't want to offend anybody. And for other people it seems to be quite the opposite. But there is some kind of constancy in each of us, and that is always in a sense going to be often going to be in some tension with a very inconstant world. Mm-hmm. But it hadn't struck me until I was working on this how much the Second Kings really sounds like the attitude of the evangelical Christian. You're not saved unless you accept Jesus Christ as God and Savior, period. You must not only worship this God, you must do it this way.
Yeah.
And there is, this can turn out some gorgeous people, some beautiful people. And the Lord is there providing the means of salvation. The problem is the tendency in that to deny that the Lord is present elsewhere offering the means of salvation, and therefore essentially damning everybody who does it differently. Mm-hmm. This is very nice little...
I know, it's great.
maybe the microphone has some kind of magic to it.
I'm not really sure what my question is, but it's a struggle with the fact of what is self, what is a good sense of self-esteem. Mm-hmm. You brought up the idea of self-esteem at the end, and where is it that you're doing the work of the Lord, and where is it that it's your program that's needed, and how can you tell the difference?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think you managed to ask a fairly direct question somehow or other. I'm very fond of a statement of Helen Keller's. Said that when things are really getting her down, and she had a lot of things that could get her down, and the one phrase she said, then comes hope with a smile and whispers, "There is joy in self-forgetfulness." And I'm more and more convinced that one of the hardest words in Swedenborg, Latin words, is the word "in." And I'm more and more convinced that in colloquial English, this could very often be translated "into," in the sense of "involved in." He's really into skateboarding or something like that. And when we are absorbed in doing something, we forget about ourselves. And as a matter of fact, if we become self-conscious, it really louses things up. If we get really, especially in interpersonal relations, if we are genuinely concerned with another person, delighted by something good that has happened, or troubled at someone's difficulties, and all of a sudden start worrying about, what am I supposed to do? What am I supposed to say? How do I look to this person? We've lost it. And I think the probable fact is that one of the deadliest traps on our spiritual path is the desire to be self-consciously happy. Because as soon as I start thinking, "Oh, look how happy I am," that's a cloud. We're happiest when we forget about ourselves and really, really get engaged in doing something worthwhile. I'm a little bit more. Stay for next week. There'll be a little more on this theme next week.
Now, one of the thoughts when you were saying about country folk and city folk, one of the things that, being more city, I tend to be a bit more objective about what the problems are with country folk. one of the things that comes to mind is that there are less people in the country, and so opinions tend to have a narrow approach, and one of the benefits of being with a large group of people is that two minds are better than one. I just sense that with some of the country folk ideas is that, that's what we think, having a freedom to change direction by opinion is a healthy one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. A couple of observations. One is one of the demotivational posters, I think I mentioned one the other day. Another one was, "None of us is as dumb as all of us." No, Lee's next in the sequence. But, one of the things that is characteristic in cities that makes this pluralism possible is that you can, without too much difficulty, find people who agree with you. You have if you live in an apartment building in Manhattan, the people you see least of may be the other people in your building. Because you are so close that if you get involved with them, there's no escape. So you very often your social circle tends to be elsewhere. But this means there can be a lot of different social circles. You don't have to adjust your opinions and your style to the people who live next to you the way you do in a small town. You don't have the same kind of pressure. Mm-hmm. What about the mute side over here?
Speaking of needing to get out of yourself, I have a theory which I haven't fully tested, but I think probably holds that in all forms of mental illness, there is some level of self-absorption and focus on the self, either by choice or unintentional. We don't know which, but that when you are mentally ill, and probably physically ill as well, a lot of your thinking tends to be focused around yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Whether that's the cause of your condition or the result of that condition, who knows? But it seems that a lot of your thinking is going to be focused on yourself when you're not well mentally or physically.
Yeah. Yeah. I take it you're not setting out a program to try all forms of mental illness to see whether this theory holds up.
I'm not going to do the Hahnemanian version. I'm testing it upon myself.
Yeah. Yeah, going back, you know, on this, and takes me back also to Debbie's question. One of the things that has finally filtered through to me is that, and I've probably said this to a number of you before, I see myself from the inside, so I can see things you can't see. You see me from the outside, and you can see things I can't see. And I have to take both of those seriously, and they contradict each other. So as far as this, you know, this self-image begins to get awfully blurry. And I think it can be a help in getting beyond a concern with self-esteem if you begin to get a little healthy uncertainty as to just what on earth this self is. Because a lot of what we're trying to rate highly to find worth in is our own construction, our own idea of who we are. And this gives me an opportunity to digress. One of the most striking things about the biblical narrative now for me is the difference in the stories of the construction of the tabernacle and the construction of the temple. The tabernacle, every detail is spelled out on Mount Sinai. And God says, do it this way, make this, make that, make this, make that. And then a couple chapters later, it says, and they made this, and they made that, and they made this, and they made that. Everything is done precisely as God commanded. In the building of the temple, God is silent. Moses, Solomon built it. Solomon did this. Solomon sent to Hiram for judgment. Solomon built this. Solomon did that. Solomon did this. There is no mention of God commanding the building of the temple, having anything to do with its construction. At the end, God says, okay, if you're good, I will pay attention to your prayers. But it's so radically different. And it has come to me, maybe this is a picture of the ideal self that I construct. On the model of the tabernacle, yes, but not... but much more my construction than the original tabernacle was. And then, of course, in the holy city, I saw no temple, period. It's gone. You know, you're on the fringes of things, but you're acceptable.
I just wanted to fill in the corner here a little bit.
Yeah.
This is on a perhaps more personal note than it should be, but I thought I would like to share it with you. Yesterday, Anita and I drove over and we saw Louise.
Mm-hmm.
And I have been feeling very sorry for myself to be alone here, without her.
Mm-hmm.
And many of you expressed very nicely how much you missed her presence here. And what I wasn't prepared for, really, I must admit, when I got to Todd's place, was I found a wife who was quite, quite happy. She was very pleased with what was going on in
That's very welcome. Very welcome.
About you talking, this is ridiculous. We're going to have to spread out. Thinking about the tabernacle, the temple, and the holy city, mm-hmm. is that stages? Would you say that would be stages in our awareness of self? You know, thinking of a very teenage self, we're very aware, and later on, how does that do with our personal development?
How much time you got? Well, actually, I'm getting on in years. It may take, might have to pass that one on to someone else. Very, very definitely. I think it is possible and useful, and I think more and more necessary to look at the biblical story and see the whole shape of the whole story, and see that as a reflection of the way our lives are designed to progress, realizing that, as Swedenborg says early in Secrets of Heaven, not all people get very far out of the first day, but it's there to be done. And the basic shape of the story, I can do this in 2 minutes flat, is the call of Abram as the sense of promise in childhood, of becoming a real grown-up person, achieving that with the establishment of the monarchy. It never says it, but when David has conquered all the enemies, the promise to Abram has been literally fulfilled. They're a great nation. And then a new sense of promise growing out of that fails. So this is the achievement of what we regarded as maturity, which is essentially, on the natural level, quote, worldly, and breaks down in midlife. And if we are going to make this transition, we have to make the transition, to use the biblical image, from our focus on the kingdom of Israel to the kingdom of heaven. That's the transition we find in the Gospels. You find the Israelites of Gospel times looking for the salvation of Israel, and you find Jesus coming saying the kingdom of, not the kingdom of Israel is going to be restored, the kingdom of heaven is at hand. And the narrative then follows there to the crucifixion, the resurrection, the ascension, and in the Swedenborgian canon, at that point, at the ascension, it follows, doesn't follow the church on earth, it follows Jesus into heaven, Revelation opens with the vision of the glorified Christ, and we have what I would take then as a picture essentially of what has to happen in the world of spirits if it hasn't happened here. That is the final sorting out, where good and evil are clearly, finally separated, and you have actually a holy city into which nothing that defiles enters. Mm-hmm. Time. Thank you.